Thank you. So you probably won't recognize this. Anyway, this is the now for something completely different picture. Yeah, I just thought we could take a little break before we get back to 21 centimeter energy injection, exotic pop three stars and so on. So this will be a bit of a break. This is based on prior work by former PI members, current PI members, and current and former students, and current student Justin Marchioni. So I'll talk about how dense the densest dark matter structure should be. So just as an introduction, dark matter, conventional dark matter, sort of CDM, works well on large scales down to about the percent level. And then it's kind of interesting to think about how well it does or doesn't work or isn't tested on smaller scales. And that was something I was thinking about a little bit recently. But in general, of course, to test models, we usually need to know how it clusters and is distributed on all scales. And that, up until recently, has been pretty much untestable observationally, but there are some things coming up now that may test this: gravitational waves, pulsar timing, substructure lensing, and so on. So really what I want to ask is, you know, if you want to know what the dark matter distribution is on all scales at all times, how do you model that, and what densities do you get to? There are famous limits on the phase space density that you can have in dark matter, the Tremaine-Gunn limit. But here what I'm interested in is more the real space density that dark matter can reach. What should that be and what limits that? And there's kind of a basic hypothesis here that doesn't have, you know, this is based on actual real physics. This is just based on sort of hand waving and looking at simulations. And the hand waving picture is that once you've assembled things into cosmological structures, you can't get that stuff back out. And I'll show you that that's sort of true empirically. So that's sort of real space, a real space limit. Once you've achieved some density, some real space density to dark matter, you're stuck. You have that stuff at that density and it stays there. So you make, in particular, you make halos from linear fluctuations. So there's a whole theory that allows you to predict that, the halo mass function. That's then assembled into things with some density profile. And I'll show you or note some of the more recent work on that. And the real question is, how does that evolve? What happens with those density profiles? So the usual approach to this, I think we had an example from Aaron's talk this morning, is to look at the concentration of dark matter halos and say, we'll say how much material is at what densities by assigning a concentration to something. And we'll look at the concentration mass relation and study that. And there are a couple of problems with this. There are several different ways of defining concentration. The normal way is just, you know, the scale radius, that should be one over this, the virial radius over the scale radius. Those assume a density profile. So they break down if the density profile isn't NFW, which it isn't on very small or very large scales. But the real problem is sort of how they're extrapolated. So at low redshift, if you study concentration, halo concentration in dark matter only simulations versus mass, you find it as a particular evolution with redshift. And that evolution used to look like 1 over 1 plus z. If you study it a little more carefully, it actually looks like it goes as 1 over the critical density. And that's what you imagine with, you have an object of a fixed mass, and all you're changing is the sort of place where you measure R200. So basically, as the cosmological background density changes, R200 changes, and that changes your concentration. And that's usually put in with no further thought about it. The problem with that is that real halos are surrounded by other matter, and as that virial radius gets bigger, their mass changes, their mass grows, and that's not usually put in. And it's funny, it seems like an obvious thing after you think about it, but that actually changes the predictions quite a bit. So that is starting from low redshift and extrapolating backwards, and you can only do that down to maybe 10 to the 7 solar masses for halos, because you can't, you just run out of dynamical range to simulate things. But the other approach is you can start from initial conditions, take a very tiny box, and run that forward. And in particular, Ishiyama did that in a series of simulations starting in 2014, and found very interesting results. The concentration he measured was actually down here. It was a concentration of one or two. But if you extrapolate it using this, you know, 1 over 1 plus z, then you get values that would be up here at the present day, this sort of red rectangle. Or if you do it as 1 over Rho squared, you get values up here. So you get sort of concentrations of kind of 30 to 60 on this plot for the lowest mass, smallest structure. And the central density is going as that concentration, maybe cubed or something. So it's quite sensitive to that number. The problem with that is it neglects this thing that as these systems evolve from high redshift to low redshift, they would actually increase in mass. And that would change the concentration further, so it would put it up here. Right? So the difference here is about a factor of between maybe 5 and 10, or I think 6 to 8 is the number I have down here. And it's funny, there's a completely analytic sort of theoretical prediction for this. From Yaryshev Shorty, who's here at PI, that where they looked at, sorry, the author list should be the other way around. It's Chiamacco who's first author on that, where they just considered what happened if you conserved energy in forming halos. And they get a relation, which is these blue stars here. And it's interesting that it's actually very close to that assumption, that if you just take energy conservation, you take the material that's in a linear peak initially, and you assume it's conserved as you make the halo, and that predicts a certain halo concentration. And that concentration is very high. And originally, they sort of set up the theory to match things down here, but then it didn't look so good that it went way high compared to other predictions here. But actually, if you make this correction to the Ishiyama results, you sort of get the right thing. Here's maybe this just plotted a little more sort of physically. The squares here are the actual densities that Ishiyama measured at redshift 32. So this was a simulation where you had to stop at redshift 32 because the box was going to go nonlinear. Right, so you could only do very high redshift stuff. Nonetheless, these are independent field halos at that redshift, and the squares or the densities measured. I was trying to convert them the other day into GeV per centimeter cubed. If you want to do that, you have to multiply by 38. Anyway, you can multiply this scale by 38 to do that. They're way, way lower than the densities we were talking about the other day. That's because you need a lot of adiabatic contraction to squeeze things to get right to get those high densities. Anyway, the interesting thing is there are the squares, and you can say if I take a present day halo and give it some concentration, what concentration do I need to give it to go through that data? And the answer is you need a concentration of something like 130 rather than 40 to 60. Whereas the low redshift, the redshift zero concentration mass relations predict sort of 40 to 60. So this argues that one of a couple of things, oh, and I should say, actually, if this, you know, in terms of consequences, if the density really is this high on very small scales, then it does various, you know, things phenomenologically. So for instance, it increases the boost factor for annihilation by an enormous amount. Sort of 30 to 60. And that means it drops constraints on candidates correspondingly. So these are the dwarf galaxy constraints. Now, I have to say I'm still digesting the whole Voyager 1, Voyager 2 thing. And I guess Voyager 1, Voyager 2 is also down here. So maybe this stuff is ruled out anyway. But this sort of says you could actually drop most of the annihilation constraints by a considerable amount, right? And it sort of rules out, thermal weak scale candidates up to a TeV or something like that. So, you know, in a sense, it makes quite a big difference to those limits. The question is this real or not? Is this correct? So there's sort of three possibilities, right? There's a disagreement here. Basically, the high redshift simulations that you run down to redshift 32 predict densities that are 5 to 10 times higher than the redshift zero simulations extrapolated back. Okay. So the three possibilities briefly, I'm going to consider that might accommodate these two things are maybe major mergers reduce the density, maybe tidal stripping reduces the density, maybe minor mergers reduce the density. And the punchline is that none of these things, we've tried now modeling all of these things and none of them work. Major mergers drop the density by maybe 10 or 20% if you have very, very extreme mergers. I won't go through the details in the interest of time, but I can come back to this. Tidal stripping, you can strip off 99% of the mass and you don't really drop, there again, you don't drop the central density by much. Minor mergers are actually really interesting. And this is where I got caught up in more recently. Minor mergers, it was pointed out, this is a paper I like to advertise because it has nothing to do with me. So no one can accuse me of being, you know, whatever, self-serving. That pointed out that when you have a merger, halo mergers actually produce these oscillations that are really, really long-lived. So if you're going to measure the concentration-mass relation, you have this problem that basically your objects are oscillating up and down in concentration from previous mergers. So we simulated this a little bit on find these large variations in concentration with time. So you have a smaller satellite come in that triggers a big response in the primary, and the whole system as a result put together has a very variable concentration. Okay, so how am I doing for time?
More or less stopped.
Okay, well then I'll go to the conclusions. Sort of basic question about structure formation, what's the highest density dark matter ever reaches? And there's kind of an uncertainty in this of a factor, maybe 5 or 10, even in very plain vanilla, nothing fancy CDM models. So not completely clear how to resolve that. If the higher estimate is correct, then it means, you know, all the constraints get better. So, okay, I will stop there. Thank you.
Time for a couple questions.
Yeah. Those dwarfs.
Those are dwarfs from that's from a number of years ago now.
I think the JFactors that they use for those are kinematics. That's completely independent of average. Like, aren't you just looking at stars, assuming a potential
transition?
So I think the thing is you're integrating over something where you don't resolve the these would be scales that are smaller than the scales you're really resolving with the stellar kinematics. Yeah, I mean it's a good point that, you know, those things have some on the scale you can measure. Those things have some effective density, and you know what that is. That's true. Yeah. So I would have to think. You're right. I mean, in that particular case, I'd have to think, what, you know, if you correct for a different profile, how much can that boost things? I think it can still boost things because you're measuring, you know, you're measuring the mean density on some big scale, but what you care about is the integral of the density squared. So you can have a boost relative to that independent of, this is just a sort of toy correction. I didn't actually calculate anything.
It's right.
Just
I mean,
a sort of schematically.
Those
yeah, well, here again, I mean, let me go back to my conclusions. Part of my conclusions was, wait a minute here, let's all agree to stop talking about concentration. Because, you know, what do you mean by concentration, right? So really what you mean is sort of the cumulative density distribution within the thing. And if you have even a small amount of the mass at very, very high densities, then that totally changes your rates.
Right.
Yeah. So, anyway, modulo. Yeah.
Okay. So, this energy conservation argument that's sort of the disagreement.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Sorry. It's not the source.
Sorry. The
I just note out of interest that a totally unrelated analytic argument happens to give you what the simulations see
at
early times. Yeah, if you just run from, you know, redshift 100 down to 30, you get some density.
Analytic argument the Lindemann conservation argument reduce the concentrations in the early redshift simulation.
Yeah.
But if I then apply that same argument to late redshift,
yeah,
then the late redshift simulations give me a much
lower density.
Just
to clarify, this is extrapolating from 10 to the 7 down to 10 to the minus 6 solar masses. So you have low redshift simulations that only resolve stuff down to, you know, whatever 10 parsec scales, and the high redshift ones only resolve it up to hundredths of a parsec scales. And the question, you know, they don't come in the same place. So the question is what's going on there? And there's no, as far as I can tell, there's no direct simulation way of resolving it, because you can't bridge that gap in a single self-consistent thing. So, yeah.